listen to that wind. It's blowing outside in Wisconsin. I think across a good part of the state, wind and weather, winter weather really is with us. And we're going to talk about forecasting winter weather. It's challenging work for a meteorologist, among other things. You know, during, you know, when it's warm, people are able to get about their day and their plans, even when the forecast isn't spot on. But that all changes when the temperatures get to freezing or thereabouts. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. That means it's time to check with the weather guys. John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
And Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, good to see you too.
It's great to be
You're
here.
You're looking chipper there.
We have NOAA visitors, so we can. Oh, so hence the tie.
So we'll talk. We'll take a look at the forecast. We'll talk about the NOAA visitors. Why are they here, and what are they up to? Maybe a little bit about that. We can talk about El Nino weather patterns. Check in. There have been some questions I've heard about the California fires and the what rain could mean out there, and does it have an impact on weather? So all those things, and you may have a weather question or maybe a weather experience you want to share with us. If so, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us as well. We always love to see the photos. The recent weather photos that you've got, you can post those at our Ideas Network page, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, you know, before we get to weather patterns, El Nino and so forth, let's talk about the challenges that meteorologists face in accurately forecasting winter weather.
Is this a perfect question for today or what? Right. Just a perfect question for today. All right. Let me tell you about it, Larry.
Right, yeah.
It's really difficult.
All the ribbing that we take.
Yeah. You know, this nonsense. Well, let's get the nonsense out of the way.
Way.
The idea that, you know, we're wrong 100% of the time, we still get paid. It's just absolute nonsense. If you keep score at home, you'll find out that we're right about 85 to 90% of the time. And If the definition of being right is painting complexion of the day accurately, we're right even more frequently than that. But here's just, we're sitting here in Madison this morning, saw a few snow flurries this morning. They didn't amount to anything, didn't even pile up on windshields. You see cars coming in to do business in town from places south of us or southeast of us with snow all over them. This was well forecasted. There was never a winter, as far as I know, there was never a winter warning or winter storm warning put on Madison itself. Those were in the counties to the south and east and then northern Illinois. And that is a testament to how incredibly accurate the forecasting has become in the modern age. It's not always right, as you said earlier. Now, you're not going to always get it right. But this was a classic example of an excellent forecast that will pass by the general public's notice because nothing happened and nothing was forecast. But that's exactly a testament to how accurate it was. Down in Rockford, they had a period last yesterday from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. 5 inches of snow fell in 1 hour. They had seven inches at about 5 o'clock, and I think they ended up somewhere in around a foot or maybe even more than a foot. Rockford, Illinois, 60 miles from us, a foot of snow, completely transformed, you know, there late November compared to ours. So how do you forecast these exceptionally narrow bands of snow in the middle of a winter storm with that kind of accuracy? It's a really hard feat because if you're off by the way that the data comes into these forecast models, one or two different points in our gridded data set will put the snow in Madison versus in Rockford. And that's not a big error. That's like making a 50-foot putt. You know, no one argues if you don't get it in. It's an exceptionally accurate shot if you do. And we're doing that more frequently than we're not at this point in the early part of the 21st century. It's a difficult task, and we're doing a good job of it.
And a week ago, we knew the storm was coming.
Yeah.
We didn't know where it was going to come.
That's right.
But people were like, whoa, heads up, you know, because it's holiday traffic, and this is not what you want to see.
Yeah, that's the right strategy. You're put on alert that something's coming, and that's accurate in and of itself nowadays, that you can put them on. We can put ourselves on alert a week in advance, and then you remain vigilant about how the actual forecast is starting to lay itself out a day, two, 3 days out in advance. and people are alerted to the fact there's something potentially going on, and then they get the skinny on it 24 hours in advance. Boy, does that make a difference.
Yeah. It does, but nevertheless, even though I knew that there wasn't going to be snow coming to Madison, I did go to the gas station and fill my little red can with a gallon of gas, and I took it back to my snowblower, mm-hmm. and I put some in, and
there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing
just wrong with to that. Make sure.
I looked at my snowblower to make sure I had access, but that was about it.
That's called preparation.
Right. I started mine up. I got it running, and I thought, well, let's hope I don't have to use it. Right.
We are wrong 10% of the time.
Robert in Green Bay has something for us.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Great, Robert. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
You guys just talking about the amounts of snow, and I know that like even last year, a vacation of mine was delayed because of that late snowstorm. But it just seems, to my opinion, that consistently we have not had the amount of snowfall as we have had as I was growing up. Would you agree? I'm in my mid-40s.
You're 40. Okay.
It's highly variable from year to year. So that part makes it difficult to discern, you know, anecdotally any trends. But I think in the very long term, the trend is for a decreasing amount of snowfall for an annual average. But the here in Madison, probably every place. But it's really highly variable. So I think the average right now is 42 inches or 40 inches of snow per cold season, beginning November 15th-ish and ending, you know, late March. And even though we had that,
this is
the biggest,
in Madison.
Yeah, and that was the biggest event we had last year was April 19th. So that's just really weird. But so that testifies to the variability. But that amount has gone down from somewhere in the mid 40s about 25 or so years ago. So that is accurate.
I totally agree. The only one thing I would add is that, you know, comparing it to when we grow up, what we remember are the big ones.
That's right.
The
ones, yeah, it's a lot,
you know,
of
it's kind of like you remember when you're wrong. You remember when school was closed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But the average sounds like it's 3 inches or so, at least for this area, and you might be able to extrapolate that out to other parts of the state.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And 3 in the face of 40-ish is hard to discern except by, you know, really rigorous statistics. Like Steve says, your memory's not going to do it quite.
Right, yeah.
So there you go, Robert. You were right. Right.
It's been snow cover has been decreasing in North America.
Yep. That's right.
Well, let's see what's on Denny's mind in Manitowoc.
Hi. It seems like Trump and some others that are doubters about climate change are just focusing on part of it, global warming. You say, well, hey, if there's global warming, why is it so cold? When warming is just part of it. So somehow I think people who want to push out knowledge about climate change need to focus on all of it, not just the global warming part.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of that. You're seeing that now with the report that came out on Friday. More and more people are talking about it. And, you know, the global warming part is the global part. And so you can have regions that are colder than normal, like we've been in most of this month.
Yeah.
But somewhere else on the globe, it's going to be much warmer than normal, so that there is a continuing trend of the globe warming up. And now that leads to many other feedbacks and changes and the weather patterns in terms of ocean temperatures, in terms of ecosystems. And I think there's been more and more talk about what those impacts are.
Right, I agree. I think the community has taken exactly your mandate by the horns. Global warming is one aspect of, you know, broad global environmental change, but really it sits at the core of it, because if that isn't happening, a lot of these other changes aren't happening either. So it's I think that's an accurate statement, but it's also fair to say that global warming's at the core of this. Yeah.
And for those who may not have seen that report, what are the highlights of that report you were talking about, Steve?
The you know, for the past, I'd say, 20, 30 years, this understanding of the fact that the globe is warming due to human activities has gone from, we think so, to now where it's, oh, no, we are certain that this is happening and that humans are having this impact.
That's correct.
So there we go. We have some other callers online. We'll get to you. I want to go back to the seasonal forecast for just a minute, though. Why are those long-range forecasts so difficult, or what skills are required? Is it a different skill set to go long range on forecasting?
Yeah, it's a whole different approach, actually. You know, the short-term weather forecast, the 2 to 3 day forecast, is based on what the conditions are today, run through a forecast model that's a translation of mathematical physical expressions into computer language, and a fairly accurate one. And then we can make what we almost call a deterministic forecast based on these current initial conditions. I can tell you what the weather will be 3 days from now. But to make a seasonal forecast, you've got to layer on top of anything that might be predictable in that same sense. You have to layer on a lot of statistics and a lot of trend information from prior years and kind of end up getting away from a purely physical forecast, and it becomes partly statistical. So there's a big difference.
And statistical, yeah, and so it's a much harder game. Much harder game, because there's all kinds of things that could throw a monkey wrench into the whole thing.
We've made a lot less progress on that problem in the last 50 years than we have on the short-term weather forecasting problem.
Well, our guests today, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, are going to be with us right up until 12:30 today as we talk with them about climate and weather. And I hope you'll join in, some callers online, but you can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us your questions and maybe your weather photos. We always love to see them. For that, just go to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with our weather guys. You stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking weather and climate today with our two guests, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve, also director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And questions for them, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got some photos, we'd love to see those. You can email those to us, and we'll take a look, tell you what we know about the cloud formations or the sunset or the sunrises or whatever else you got. So give a call. And I know you guys have NOAA visitors today.
Yeah, so we have the NOAA Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Environmental Observation and Prediction, Dr. Neil Jacobs, visiting campus today and part of tomorrow. And he's holding a public event today at 2:30. Doors open at 2 o'clock in the Union South on Varsity Hall, I think it is. And he'll be taking public questions. He's in charge of, that position is in charge of the National Weather Service. And so if you have questions about where NOAA is going in the future with their weather forecasting, this is a good time to talk to some of the NOAA
really
leadership.
Really cool. So 2:30 today on the UW-Madison campus, yeah. Union South.
Yep, second floor.
Can get there by 2, I guess.
Doors open at 2.
Free?
Free event. Yep.
Free event open to the public. There we go. That sounds good. We'll mention that again near the end, so as a kind of a reminder. But let's go to Mike in Madison, who has something for us. Mike, hi. Oh,
thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have, just to go back a little bit, you guys were talking about forecasting. It seems people are generally accepting the forecast more, except for we still don't have any acceptance of global warming on a big scale, because people are flying and driving more than ever. I think global warming is the furthest thing from their mind. It's kind of like, who wants to talk about death? It's kind of the same thing. And as a result, we're in trouble. I told this to my son-in-law. And NOAA and the National Weather Service were deniers until probably real recently. I know my brother worked for the region in Minnesota that covers this area, and he essentially got fired for talking about global warming.
I read a piece of good news over the weekend, and that is that, you know, this whole thing about global warming, scientists have understood this for a while. And then politicians and others have been trying to confuse the public by throwing in pieces of information that make you confused. It's an intentional thing. The tobacco industry, it did that back in the 50s and 60s. But what I recently read is that the majority in the U.S. now understand that global warming is a real event. And so finally the message is getting through, I think, to folks that, yeah, no, the scientists, we know what we're talking about, that there's physical basis behind us and there's observations that support it as well.
You can only visit so many devastating forest fires and Category 5 hurricane landfalls and, you know, all sorts of other types of things and continue to cling to your misguided view that there's nothing going on. It's easy to grandstand and suggest that today's cold weather is proof that, you know, there's no such thing as a general warming of the Earth's climate. But that's nonsensical, and it's nonsensical on its face. You have to turn one page of the big book of research, and you realize that's a goofy argument, and you move on, and you try and make a better one. So Steve's exactly right. There's the so-called merchants of doubt, to steal Naomi Oreskes' term, that was mostly for the people in the tobacco industry, but it definitely applies to our leadership now. People don't want it. Talk about this problem, and that's un-American. We're a country that faces challenges, has faced challenges through the centuries, and every time we face it, we meet it with courage and we meet it with success. This is another example of that, if we took it on.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your call very much. There's another Mike, this one in Algoma, with a question. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I'm just curious, could you update the information that's available regarding the global current flow and the potential effect that might have on climate change in the future?
Okay.
Yeah, there are a lot of ideas about this. Certainly the ocean does a huge amount, 30% of the amount of heat transport from the equatorial regions toward the polar regions. So that's a huge part of the global energy balance on Earth. And when it starts to get changed by the chemical composition of the atmosphere and the radiation balance, which is another huge part of it, then the ocean circulations get changed as well. And the question is, to what extent will changes in the ocean circulations manifest themselves as major long-term climate changes? And one of the variables is the Gulf Stream in the Atlantic, North Atlantic Basin is fueled to some extent by storms that rake the North Atlantic, cool the top surface water, make it more saline by evaporating water off of it, and really drive a major circulation in the ocean called the thermohaline circulation. And if the storm track is changed in a substantial way, then there's reason to believe the thermohaline circulation will be changed in a substantial way, and there may be a shutdown of some of that export of heat from the equatorial regions to the pole. So there's a lot of feedbacks between how the atmosphere and the ocean will interact in an altered climate. And so we know some of them, we don't know all of them.
Thank you for that call. Let's go to Gene in Madison. Your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi there. I haven't paid much attention to weather forecasting on TV in recent years, but the past few days, I think Friday and Saturday, the local weather people were comparing or making comments about the European model and the North American model
of forecasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were, with this blizzard coming our way, they were saying that the North American model had Madison right in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
European model had it going south of us. And I guess I'd be curious to know who develops those models and what are the differences?
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. The models are developed by people who have spent their careers doing the very computer programming and translation of the physical equations that govern the atmosphere and approximations to them that we have to make into computer code. And then so that's a vast landscape. Because computer power and computer coding and the use of satellite information and various other things to ingest data into those models, that's where a lot of different changes and or different differences between the two modeling communities have arisen. And I think maybe you know more about the satellite pot of it than I do, but the satellite pot, I think, is a large pot of how the European Senate has a different model than what comes over from North America.
Yeah, the European model tends to keep more of the satellite data in their initial conditions, and that helps identify something. And you see a lot of this comparison when you get the kind of storm that we had, you know, where there's a very tight gradient, because any small shift could really mean a change.
It makes
in the amount
a huge difference.
Yeah.
That's right, for given regions. And yeah, the European Center model was consistently tracking this storm south of us, and the models developed here by our weather service were bouncing a little bit back and forth. But they zeroed in by T minus 24 or 36 hours, so they got it right, but they weren't consistently right. And some people consider that a major problem. I'm not sure I agree with them.
And our NOAA visitor is the administrator that kind of oversees the directions of where those U.S. community models are going to be going to.
So that will be a big part of his conversation today, I'm sure.
Oh, very interesting. Thank you, Gene. Appreciate your call. Robin in Sturgeon Bay, your turn.
Yeah, hi, guys. I spend the winters in Costa Rica for the last 25 years on the Pacific coast. And what I've noticed is rapid changes from El Nino to La Nina. And in the past, it had been, you know, 5 or 6 years apart. And now we're seeing them happen annually. And that, in turn, affects our weather here. And I just wondered if you could comment on that.
All right.
I think within that 25-year span, there's probably been two major El Nino events. The 1997-98 was one of them, and then, was there one? 2000? Yeah, there was one not long ago, 2003.
2012, maybe?
Maybe 2011-12. Yeah, that was another one that was supposed to be really rainy in Southern California. So there's been two major events. It's interesting you say the coast of on Costa Rica. I wonder if even minor shifts have regional manifestations that people notice, either in fishing or various other things in the ocean, so that they might not translate to major impacts across the entire basin, but might be major in local regions, because there's only really been two big ones. And I don't know that the frequency of alteration from positive to negative, that is warm El Nino, cold La Nina, has increased or decreased over that 25-year period on the large scale. I'm not aware if that's the case.
Interesting. Thank you, Robin. Appreciate your call. As long as we're on, you've been blogging about El Nino weather patterns. So maybe remind us, what is an El Nino weather pattern like?
So for our region, usually what it means statistically is in the wintertime, we get less snowfall. So these are the kind of weather that John hates.
I hate El Nino. I hate it. I do. It's true.
And we're in a weak one. We're going into a weak one. Now, the stronger it is, the harder the correlation is. So it's hard to tell in terms of what will happen. I think NOAA's seasonal forecast is still looking at a warmer than normal winter time, but is unsure about precipitation.
Okay. On to Jeff in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Hey, I had heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I was just curious, how much impact does the methane from all the livestock have on the ozone compared to, like, automobiles and industry?
I'm not aware of any chemical interaction between methane and ozone.
I don't think so either.
You bring up a good point, though, about exhaust from automobiles. Under the right conditions, that can be turned into an ozone problem. That's definitely true.
Yeah, on sunny days. And
often hear about cattle, you know, worldwide, and the gases that they...
So methane is a strong greenhouse gas,
right?
It tends to lean more to global warming, and there is some issues around that, because there's a lot of methane, for example, in the tundra of the Arctic regions. And so there's a lot of, and also in lakes, and so there's questions about, as the Earth warms up, whether or not there'll be more methane released that's binded underground. But that doesn't impact the ozone.
No, I don't think so. And then the other similar thing in lower latitudes is clearing land to raise livestock in the subtropics is a bad idea to take the trees out because they suck up carbon dioxide. And then the methane adds another gas to the atmosphere that does the same thing as the carbon dioxide. So it's a double loss.
Yeah.
You're adding more greenhouse gas.
Jeff, does that help?
Yeah, a little bit. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for calling. So, Ed in Lodi, it's your turn. So let's turn to you. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, my question is to piggybacks on just what we've talked about. I wonder if what work's being done on environmental forecasting. I know we do the weather forecasting, but just like he was talking about with methane and the forest reductions and the crop activity, population, all the construction, like in Madison, you know, that takes away the way to absorb. Is there work in the futurist sense on the environmental type forecasting?
Yeah, there's a lot of research and development going on in terms of coupling the weather models with the ecosystem models. A good example, or in terms of my mind, is the forecasting of water qualities in the Great Lakes. Mm. So they're looking at, you know, there's obviously an interaction between the weather and whether or not you get algae blooms. And so trying to develop those type of forecasting models in terms of closing beaches and things like that. So that's developing more and more.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I'm not an expert on that, but I know that there's a huge population of very talented people working on those kinds of interrelated problems. Yeah, we've got a really good expert in our own faculty, Ankur Desai.
It becomes really complicated. I mean, it's complicated just to forecast one aspect of it, whether it's the weather or the ecosystem, but then to couple them together becomes a really tough problem.
Yeah,
yeah, there we go. Thank you, Ed. Appreciate the call. Patricia in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. In mid-afternoon today, there's supposed to be some Mars probe or getting near Mars, and I was wondering if there's anything there that you weathermen are going to glean from the information they get from the launch.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of weather, the interesting aspect between Mars and Earth are dust storms.
Yeah, global dust storms.
They get global dust storms. And we get some big dust storms, and they can go from Africa all the way up to the North Pole or to Florida. Mars gets global dust storms. The whole entire planet will be covered with dust.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And they're landing a probe. I think NASA's landing a probe on Mars coming up. I saw
today.
An article, though I didn't read it. Yeah, yeah, that it's supposed to be really challenging to actually do that.
Yeah, and I don't think they send any spacecraft to another world, especially to a solid surface like Mars, without having some at least basic meteorological instruments on there. I'm sure that they do, because I think that the global gust storm problem is a really interesting problem. I think we're going to learn more about it from satellites orbiting the planet than we are from individual measurements, but the measurements are always of great interest. Imagine getting a morning sunrise temperature at a site somewhere in Mars every day for the next 15 years. That's really exciting, just conceptually exciting.
It wouldn't collect any data, though, weather data. I think she may have been asking, too, on the way up, is it collecting data that we might find useful back here?
Not for forecasting our weather, but for understanding geophysical processes better, it certainly is going to be a factor. I mean, I think anything you learn about global dust storms on Mars can have some impact on dust storms that are regional in the U.S. On Earth.
Yeah. I mean, physics is physics.
Right.
Right. And so
that's a great thing.
I guess
about
the big thing that lacks in Mars that we have on Earth is water. But, you know, other than that part of it, you know, forces are all going to be there.
No phase change, but global storms.
Right, but global storms.
That's a fascinating problem.
There you go, Patricia. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, those California wildfires have been raging, and I think still are. There's another one out there, isn't there?
Still
going.
I mean, some of them come out because of the rain. But
so
yeah,
several inches
of
rain coming down is going to probably create problems.
Yeah, that stuff that's left behind, the ash and soot, is really fine grain. So you end up with this kind of thick, very slick, greasy mud. And with a lot of rain in that, you end up with a chance for substantial amounts of mass to just slide off of hillsides. And that's one of the big risks after a wildfire is big landslides. So I think that's going to be the next round of related damage potential in California.
And talk about, you know, the ecosystem forecasting. When there were a few years ago, there were big fires in Colorado and Wyoming. And then after they were all out, I went out there and went up one of the canyons of the Poudre River. Mm. That Poudre River was ink black. So, you know, once it rains and all that stuff comes down, it's really changes the ecosystem.
Yeah, and then you got you got fish problems.
You got fish problems.
All kinds of other problems.
You got probably contaminants in that.
Right.
Some of those fires.
Yeah.
Some of the ash.
It do the. And someone wondered if the California wildfires impact our weather here, or there even.
They do there. I mean, they had. I think they had San Francisco last week or the week before had the worst air quality of any city in the world, and it's hard to beat Beijing. It's really hard to beat Beijing because they don't have any regulations at all.
Yeah.
So if you don't like regulations, move to Beijing and see how you like that. So it was. That's one really big impact. I would say that the weather in California that spawned the fires and promoted them was related to the weather that the broad circulation that got us cold for the first half of November. So I'd say there's a relationship, but not a causal relationship. Yeah.
David emailed to say he thinks that people should know that when forecasters are making their forecasts, they're usually using four or more computer models that sometimes have different outcomes, as we were kind of talking about. And it's the skilled training and education of the forecasters to kind of ferret out the accurate forecast. Is that correct? Does one model or the other or another offer the best consistent results, is his question.
I think that that's a fair statement on the front end of that, that an experienced professional weather forecaster trained in the background physics of the atmosphere and especially daily making contact with the output from these sophisticated models will grow a certain sensitivity towards situations in which one model or the other, based on maybe a few clues that come along and a comparison between what you see on the satellite right now and what you see portrayed in a six-hour forecast that's approximately the same time as your satellite, will start to notice, I think this one's got a better solution brewing right now, and I trust it better from 6 to 24 hours than I do this other one. And you start to bias yourself towards looking at that. And that's a reasonable thing to do. I think that's an absolutely reasonable thing to do. I wish I had that skill. I'm terrible at forecasting. People who are good at it have that skill.
Well,
you're terrible at it.
Oh, I'm terrible at it. But it's a function of not enough attention put
to it.
Yeah,
you have to put time into
it. Yeah, and when you do, and if you're really interested in it, and you do that as your profession, you get good at that.
Yeah. Are you better than a groundhog?
Definitely.
Well, I was going to say, have you got your copy of Farmer's Almanac?
I do. Yeah, you gave it to me a couple of months ago, and I've got it prized.
You can always fall back to that.
Yeah. That's it. Those rodents are really smart, you know. I have to surrender my intelligence to them.
Somebody just who joined late wonders about the winter, and I think you kind of got into that as to what snowfall and so forth. Probably, maybe a little less snow this year?
Yeah. I mean, I would. It's a weak El Nino that's trying to get itself together. If that got stronger, we definitely would have less snow. But we're in a warming climate. So if you don't know, if you don't have a strong signal pointing you in one direction or another, I think the smart thing to do is probably bias yourself toward a slightly milder than normal winter.
Yep, go for warm.
Yeah,
why not?
So,
that's,
and I think
that's the two-decade trend.
Yeah, and it's probably the baseline statement that they make in the seasonal forecasting world.
Well, guys, it's awesome. And by the way, again, just mention again your NOAA person.
Yeah, so we have Dr. Neil Jacobs here. He's the NOAA Assistant Secretary of Commerce and Environmental Observations and Predictions, and he'll have a public free event at Union South starting at 2:30.
Yeah.
On the UW-Madison campus, the doors open at 2 at the Union South...
Varsity Hall.
Varsity Hall. That's
second
a nice
floor.
Hall. Yeah. And a big hall. Holds a
it's
lot
a
of people.
Hall.
So
gigantic,
a free event. So get out there and take a look at it. And John and Steve, you're back January 28th. We'll do it all over again.
All right.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, University of Wisconsin, professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. They'll be back on January 28th. So tomorrow... at this time, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be with us to talk about what you need to know when you bring home a new puppy. So join us for that. And hey, in the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.